She was this gun-toting, whiskey-drinking broad.
The super epic fucking broad.
She was a pioneer in the industry.
She's also so famous and so controversial.
So controversial.
So she's kind of a big fucking deal.
Her story is so incredible.
She belongs on this podcast because she's a broad you should know. Hello and welcome to Broads You Should Know, the podcast about amazing and noteworthy women from history. I am your host, Sarah Gorski, and I am here again today with the lovely Miss Amelia Hamill. Hi, Amelia.
Hi, it's great to be back. Thank you for having me.
Yes, thank you for coming back. Thank you for not running away after our first recording session. I'm really glad to have you.
These broads are definitely people we should know, so I'm on board 100%.
I'm still thinking about Harriet Tubman, actually.
I know, she's amazing. Cool.
She was amazing. Well, I am really excited to bring you this broad today. I haven't even told you who it is, so it's going to be a surprise.
I know.
But I want to tell like the backstory because it connects in with some stuff we've done previously on the podcast. And I'm such a nerd about bringing things like full circle and connecting the dots for all these broads. So anyway, the backstory on how I found this broad, and actually the broad I'm going to do next week as well, is I was like recently browsing the webs like you do, and you see memes and you see things fly by. And there was this tweet from Stephen King, the horror writer, one of our favorites, right?
Absolutely.
And it was a tweet that he had posted, regarding the treatment of his wife, Tabitha, by newspaper headlines. So longtime listeners, you will probably remember that Stephen King's wife's name is Tabitha, and she literally like paid the bills, kept the lights on for them when he was first writing before he was really well known. He was like working all night and like teaching during the day, and they were so poor, and she was working too and raising their family, and literally, you know, so she had the unpaid labor of, you know, house rearing family, and then she also was working. And but her helping support the family is basically what allowed Stephen the space to write, and then he became really big, and now he's so famous. And that was all in a podcast episode back from actually 2021. I did an episode called Behind the Scenes Broads that were like the broads behind the men that we know, right?
Yeah.
So anyway.
Well, and I'm sure she cared for him after he got hit by that car too.
Oh, I forgot that.
Yeah, I remember he was jogging and he got hit by a car, and it took him a few years to recover from that. So.
Oh my gosh. No, I don't remember that at all.
But
well, I also have a pea brain memory for like,
that's okay.
Everything except
for... It just
made
me think of that because that was after he was famous, but I'm sure she's still...
Oh, yeah. And she's a badass. She's a badass part of her own accord. But anyway, this tweet. So I'm just going to read the tweet because I don't feel like summarizing it does it any better justice. So Stephen King tweets, quote, "My wife is rightly pissed by headlines like this," quote, "Stephen King and his wife donate $1.25 million to New England Historic Genealogical Society," end quote. "The gift was her original idea, and she has a name, Tabitha King." Her response follows. "Dear editors, married to a wife or a husband, in recent media coverage of a gift that my husband, ironic usage, and I made to the New England Historical Genealogical Society, we became Stephen King and his wife. Wife is a relationship or status. It is not an identity. You could have made other choices. You could have referred to me as of Stephen, or his old lady, or his ball and chain. I have sons. You could have referred to me as mother of novelists. I have a daughter, but wouldn't it just be silly to refer to me as mother of clergy? I'm 70. I thought I would give you permission if of Tabitha predeceases me to title my obituary Relic of Stephen King. In the meantime, you might consider the unconscious condescension in your style book and give women their names," end quote.
That's amazing.
And this is all in the Twitter chain, right?
Yeah.
And AP, who was the one who published the article in the first place, like immediately updated their headline to read Stephen King and his wife, fellow novelist Tabitha King, have donated. So they changed it. This tweet just like, you know, tickles my feminist fancy, obviously. And obviously we'd already covered like Tabitha King, and I'm like, oh yeah, I'm all into this. And then I swear not 2 days after I see this post, I've subscribed to this weekly newsletter called The Marginalian. Which I actually found through Broad's research. Like, she has written about some of a Broad I was covering, and I found her magazine and I was like, oh my God, I love her writing. She brings in like all of these poets and authors, and it's just like really thoughtful, soulful, I don't know, spiritual thoughts, but not spiritual like woo woo, just like, you know, what is love? What is the soul? What is, you know, all these things. Anyway, it's basically the only thing I subscribe to, and I just love it.
I'll have to check it out.
Yeah, I'll have to send it to you, Amelia. But there was this really interesting passage in last week's email that was talking about the wives of Tolstoy and Dostoevsky. Okay. And of course, they have names.
They do.
Sophia Tolstoy and Anna Dostoevsky. Oh. Although in Russian, the actual Russian language is Sofia Dostoyevskaya and Anna Dostoyevskaya. That's how the Russian language works. Right. But that's the Anglified version.
You're right.
And specifically, there was this passage in the newsletter for Marginalian that read, quote, "With an eye to the complicated marriage of Sofia and Leo Tolstoy, so different from that of Anna and Fyodor Dostoevsky, the initial mutual infatuation, the 13 children, the selflessness with which Sofia transcribed all of Leo's writings, the mutual resentment of the end, dot, dot, dot." There's more there, but that's the relevant. And I read the sentence and I was like, I have got to research Sofia Tolstoyeva. I was like, who is this woman? She transcribed all of War and Peace. So that's who I'm bringing today. And that's the backstory. That's the very long backstory of how I'm getting to there. And next week, I want to talk about Anna Dostoevskaya because she is also very cool. But one Broad at a time, right?
Yeah.
So I'm immediately hooked. I'm like a little bit of a Ruski file. Like, I studied abroad in Russia in college. I love, it's like self-subscribed, love Russian literature. Particularly, I fucking love Tolstoy and Dostoevsky. Like, I think they're great. But I had never heard a word about their wives, right? Like, never. It's only them. So I'm like, I was just super excited to do this research and to learn more. And turns out with the Tolstoys, there is fucking drama. So much
drama.
That
doesn't shock me from Russia. You know what I mean? Like,
I mean, it's no different than like the drama of like reality TV, I feel like. I don't know.
Absolutely.
It's like a Russian specific thing.
If they would just sell history that way and be like, this is like the olden times Real Housewives.
Yeah.
Maybe people would be more excited about it.
It's not the same as Real Housewives, like story-wise, but it's like dramatic enough that it could be. And it has been turned into a movie. Actually, I just watched it. There's a movie in... oh my gosh, I think it was 2011, called The Last Station, with Christopher Plummer, handsome Love Christopher him. Plummer, and Helen Mirren playing Sofia.
Ooh.
And it was interesting. And it was, oh, and also, what's his face from, why do I always forget his name?
That one guy.
From X-Men. He plays the young Professor X. I always forget his name. I'm terrible.
Oh, McAvoy?
Yeah. James McAvoy is in it too.
James McAvoy.
I just love him. Why do I forget his name if I love him? I don't know. So anyway, the movie was okay, but I felt like after like doing the research on Sofia, I was like, okay, this is definitely like a very particular flavor of viewpoint and not the flavor that I'm subscribing to.
Right.
But it still was an interesting movie. And Christopher Plummer and Helen Mirren are amazing, of course.
Obviously.
But anyway, let's talk about Sofia.
Is that what he won his Oscar for?
They were both nominated for that movie, but I don't think that they won.
Because he won an Oscar like right before he passed.
Did he?
Yeah.
Well, then let's do a quick Googles.
The same year that like Jonah Hill was up for Wolf of Wall Street, and there were like a bunch of other people.
Let me look. I'm Googling.
Okay, cool.
Best actor in Beginners.
Oh, okay.
In 2011. So Last Station was in 2009, 2 years before that.
Okay, great.
Yeah, so you're not wrong, but it wasn't this movie. He was really excellent. He plays Leo Tolstoy.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just judgy because it's like, you know, not the feminist viewpoint I think it should have.
That that most movies are not the feminist at which we would like them to be. Let's be real, Sarah.
My mom keeps telling me, like, why don't we produce these stories for about all these women? I'm like, why don't we? Like, why don't we make movies about all of these women? And maybe one day, if there's anyone listening who has buckets of producer money, give me a call, because I'm really into that idea.
Me too. Screenwriter, amazing, amazing actor. We're ready.
We're ready. We're ready. All right, let's get back to Sophia. So Sophia Bears was her name. And she was born in 1844, and her daddy was a German doctor, and her mom was Russian, and they were pretty high class in Russian society. Her family was like count and countess, and apparently her mom's grandfather was Russia's very first minister of education. And they were all very well educated, including Sophia. She spoke at least like three languages at some point in her life, possibly more. And I don't have a lot about her early life in my research, but when she's just 18 years old, she is introduced to Leo Tolstoy, who was 34 at the time. It's like worth saying that age gap was not unusual at the time.
No.
And he was still, at this point, he's still kind of at the beginning of his career. He had written The Cossacks, which was a short novel, and it was kind of a hit. So he was like starting to be kind of a recognizable name, but he had not yet written any of those works that made him super famous.
Right.
And not too long after they meet, like within, I think the same year, they like meet in court and he proposes marriage, and they are married in September of 1862 in Moscow. And apparently they are very passionate for each other. It's not like an arranged, calculated marriage. Like, there's like really something there intellectually and otherwise. But get this, the bullshit starts right away. The night of their wedding, Leo shares his diaries with Sophia. They were both like prolific diary, like they wrote in their diaries constantly throughout their lives.
Sure.
Which isn't something that I do, but I understand that some people love to write in diaries.
Yeah, yeah.
I understand it's a thing people love. So Leo shares his diaries with her, including all of these passages of him recounting all of the sex he's had with a bunch of the servants on his property, including one that bore his child. And like, they still work there. She still works there. And like, this illegitimate child is like there.
How very Arnold Schwarzenegger of him.
It's like on their marriage night. And she's like, what the fuck? Because that was news to her. And I guess, like, maybe he, like, thought it was, like, coming clean and wanting to be honest. But, like,
yeah,
I don't know. That was pretty fucked up.
I have to say, as a wedding night, would not be my choice.
Yeah. Like, how do you get it on after that moment? Like, what do you...
Well, especially, I'm and she's how old at this point? 14, you said?
No, 18. She's 18.
18.
But still.
Still, that's not...
Still. So she gets through it. There's various like sources that are like, oh, she was always a little jealous or she always struggled with that. And I was like, well, I don't feel like that's a thing to judge about. I feel like I would be upset too. Like, I don't know. I'm kind of like, I don't have a lot of super details from like the early years of their marriage, but during the course of their marriage, she becomes pregnant 16 times and she gives birth 13 times.
Ouch.
And 8 of those babies make it to adulthood, which is also common of that era, right? A lot of children died of illnesses and things like that. So she spent, you know, that's like what? That's 20 years pregnant. Like,
at least.
Insane. And it's a very well-known fact when you like, you know, Google about it, that she was the copyist for War and Peace, one of his biggest, best novels. Absolutely. She copied and edited the manuscript 7 times from beginning to end, like at night after everybody, the kids and the servants all went to bed with like by candlelight with like an inkwell pen and a magnifying glass reading all of Leo's notes and things like that. She copied it 7 times. You guys know that book is huge, right? I should have it.
I know.
It's on my shelf.
Like, it's like the phone book. It's huge.
Wait, I'm going to do something I never do and leave camera for 1 second.
Okay. Hi, Frida Kahlo.
Here it is. This is my copy of War and Peace, which is like
also
it's, like tiny print. It's like it's huge. This tiny print large page version is, let me see, how many pages long? 1,178. Seven times she hand wrote this shit. Like, oh my gosh, I can't even imagine. I couldn't do that. I would be like, why don't you do your own work, bud?
Between the handwriting and the childbirth, that woman was in pain an awful lot.
An awful lot. She also handled much of his publishing. She published 8 editions of his complete collected works. And for the most part, she handled like many stages of that publishing process herself. I already said her dad was a doctor. She also kind of, she wasn't a doctor like licensed, but she basically learned a lot from her dad. And she basically would practice medicine. She would assist the peasants around their property like free of charge. During Russia's big famine in 1890, she helped Leo organize a major relief operation. She managed all of their family's business and estate affairs, in addition to the like child rearing. So she herself nursed and educated all of their children, and she served as Leo's translator. And she also was a really accomplished, would you believe it, photographer, which was a very new art form at the time. Yeah. That was kind of like front and center.
Yeah.
And she would end up taking like over 1,000 photographs that were documenting her and their life. And her collection of photos is also like this. I'm sure this is not her intention when she took them, but it also kind of like really clearly documents the decline of the Russian Empire, because that's around the time period, like towards the end of their life is when the Russian Revolution happened and all that. And she also was a writer herself. She wrote her, like I already said, profuse diaries. She also wrote 2 novels, none of which were published until the following century, which I will circle back to in a second. Okay. And when Leo's novel, The Kreutzer Sonata, was banned, she personally petitioned Alexander III, the Tsar, to have it unbanned, even though it was widely thought that that novel kind of documented their, what was becoming an increasingly turbulent marriage. And she was successful. The Tsar was like, okay, you're right. Like, we'll bring the book back. And Leo said multiple, so there's like different phases of Leo's life, which I'm about to talk of in a second. But like throughout their marriage, he made it very clear that she was basically his muse for much of his writing. He said, like, beyond all of the literal physical things she did, copying and publishing, she was, so her biographer says, quote, during War and Peace, Tolstoy told many people how his marriage changed him. Quote, I've never felt my intellectual powers and even all my moral powers so free and so capable of work, end quote. And a visitor to Yasnaya Polyana, which is the what their estate was called, the name of their estate, during this time called Sophia, quote, the perfect wife for a writer, end quote, and nursemaid of her husband's talent. And she loved Leo's art and she inspired his best achievement. Her emotional support was indispensable to the writer who constantly struggled with depression. After 35 years together, he wrote her, quote, you gave me the world what you were able to give. You gave me and the world what you were able to give. End quote. So
she clearly was smart.
She was incredibly smart, and she also like was this like workhorse for him and their family. And so she's like a hero, right? We hear all these things and we're like, holy fucking shit, this woman is incredible.
Yeah.
Guess what?
Uh-oh.
The world hated her.
Oh, why though?
That's a great question. And I have the answers. Okay. So if you do like a generic Google about her or Tolstoy's wife or if you watch the movies about her, if you watch The Last Station, or if you ask, if you have Russian friends and you're like, yeah, what's the deal with Tolstoy's wife? They're going to be
so
like
asking the woman in accounting tomorrow.
I would be curious because it kind of depends on if she's read some of the newer literature. But if you ask people and if you Google about her, people say like, oh man, she was a bitch. She was a snob. She was a shrew and she was kind of insane. And Leo Tolstoy basically hated her and ran away at the end of their marriage. And arguably the most famous line, have you read Anna Karenina by chance?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Oh my God. Fucking great book.
It's such a good book.
Such a good book. But what, arguably the one of the most famous lines in Anna Karenina is in the opening of the book, which says, quote, all families are alike. All happy families are alike. Each unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. End quote. Yeah. Yeah. And many scholars attribute that line and the characters and happenings in Anna Karenina as a reflection of this Tolstoy marriage. And Kreutzer Sonata, which I already talked about,
yeah,
is ultimately a story about a man who murders his wife, and like a really terrible marriage. And that was widely believed to be a depiction of their unhappy marriage. And in fact, and like Sophia, like, did not like that book and she wished he didn't publish it. Like, she, you know, she, and she even wrote a novel like as her defense of it, like against it, or her answer to it, I guess you could say. So like, what the hell's going on here? Like, why is there this like amazing woman and then there's this like reviled wife vibe? And it's because Tolstoy takes this hard pivot. So he's this amazing novelist writing all these classics that we now love. Mm-hmm. But he pivots towards the end of his life and he turns like a hard right into like Christian aestheticism. He converts to Christianity and he becomes kind of an extremist. And his views become, when I say that, like that aestheticism, that's like, you gotta be celibate. You can't have worldly goods. You've gotta live the simple life and not, you know. And so he started to kind of preach all of this stuff. And he kind of created his own like pseudo branch of Christianity, like with his own flavor of it. Which, by the way, he did not actually, like, he preached all this shit, but he also like wasn't doing it. Like, he did not give up his estate and he was still having sex. They had 16 pregnancies. Like, he was not a celibate man. Like, and
neither so were the majority of the popes. Let's be real.
let's be totally real. Yeah. So he's preaching all this stuff, but he like, but his preaching, you know, as well as his literature has, you know, he's got a huge following from his literature, and then he starts to preach all this stuff and he starts to accrue kind of a following. And like, for lack of a better word, he has like a bunch of these little disciples that are like become like in his circle and like all around him and supporting him. And one of these disciples is named Vladimir Chertkov. And this dude, Vladimir, becomes obsessed with becoming Tolstoy's like closest confidant and advisor. No doubt, it seems like for like his own fame and his vanity. And also one of the sources I was researching was like, oh yeah, him and Tolstoy were having a huge like intimate affair. And oh my God, I didn't know. And no, that was one of the sources. So I'm only going to say it as one source and maybe not the fact, but because of the turn all this takes, like, it actually seems like that could be true. So basically this guy, Vladimir, he starts to run this huge smear campaign against Sophia, and he pushes and he pushes and he pushes Leo to change his will. And in 1910, Chertkov like writes up a new will and has Tolstoy sign it. And this new will appoints Chertkov as the sole executor of the literary estate. And he like becomes, he also becomes his representative abroad. So he's like speaking for Tolstoy in all of these business dealings and all of these things he's doing. And then like, towards the very end, this is right up the at the end of Tolstoy's life, he also like convinces Tolstoy to leave Sophia and leave their estate. And he gets on a train, Tolstoy does, and while he's on this train, he falls even more ill than he already wasn't very well, and then he's on the train and he gets so ill and they have to stop the train, and he's at this train station in Ostapova, and Chertkov is like with him, and Sophia comes to him because they write her and they're like, oh, he's really sick. I think his daughter goes with him. It's very dramatic, very dramatic. but they don't let Sophia come in and see him. And he's like on his deathbed. And Tolstoy dies at this freaking railroad station at the age of 82. Yes. And the smear campaign doesn't stop because Chirkov now like has like control over some of these publishing rights. And he ends up like preventing any of Sophia's own accounts of how things happened from ever coming to light. He prevents them from being published. So the only stories that Russians heard and anybody, Russians and therefore everybody heard, was like all of this bullshit about what a horrible wife she was and how crazy she was and how awful and how worldly and like all of the shit. There was this,
That's how it happens though. It's always the wife's fault. Have you noticed that like throughout history? It's always the wife's fault.
Yes. I feel like the whole thing is like best summarized by her biographer. So I'm just going to like read this quote.
Yeah.
Quote, Sophia's role beside Tolstoy was extraordinarily complex. She was married to a writer of genius who became a religious leader and founder of his own brand of Christianity. As such, Tolstoy distanced himself from all practical affairs. In 1883, he gave Sophia power of attorney to manage their property. She alone supported their large family with her publishing proceeds. And at the same time, Tolstoy criticized her publishing activity because it made him appear contradictory. He had renounced property and money, and yet she was making a profit by selling his books. Tolstoy was hypocritical because he also asked Sophia to contribute her profit to his causes. He publicly criticized Sophia for failing to comply with his beliefs. His criticism, given his fame and moral authority, undermined her reputation in society and in her own family. And during the last decade of their marriage, she faced disapproval from Tolstoy and his religious followers for everything she did as a publisher, a mother, and estate manager. Tolstoy's position was also difficult. He faced pressure from his disciples who wanted him to practice what he preached. So blaming Sophia for his own failure to live in accordance with his teaching became convenient.
Well, yeah.
Every
story needs a villain.
Every story needs a villain. And in this case, you know, then Chertkov is profiting off of the publishing and the rights all eventually get back to her. I think she petitions the state. I didn't write that down what year that happened. She lives another 9 years after he dies on Yasnaya Polyana. She survives the Russian Revolution and she lives like relatively peacefully until she dies in November 4th, 1919. But her work, the things that she wrote, remained unpublished until, can you guess?
I'm going to say probably till after, like, you know, in the 21st century. Like, really.
You're not wrong. Apparently there was some diaries were released in 1929, but not all of them. That's only 10 years after she died. But they weren't really translated until the 1980s, and they weren't widely released until 2010. Her memoir about her life and Tolstoy's life together was finally published in 2001, and it wasn't available in Russia till 2011.
Oh, wow.
And her novel...
They needed them to keep hating her.
So. Yeah, yeah. Like, basically... It was prevented from being published. They like hid it and they wouldn't allow it to come out. And her novel, Whose Fault, which was kind of her rebuttal to the Kreutzer Sonata, was finally published in 2008. And this woman who I quoted a bunch in the research I just went through, Alexandra Popov, like, thank God for her, because I feel like her alone has like restored the full information about like what was really going on and all of this insanity and all that she did. And that Leo himself is like, I didn't include all these quotes from him, but there's all these quotes of Leo being like, you're the love of my life. I couldn't do this without you. Like, they wrote letters to each other like daily, like, and they did have like turbulent times and they argued a lot towards the end because he basically adopted all those very extreme ideals, and he expected her to just kind of like flip the switch and go with him.
Yeah.
But like, she's her own person, and like, I don't know, that it's an unreasonable expectation, right? Like, oh, I suddenly believe this and I've developed this new religion, you must believe it too. Like, what the fuck?
Exactly.
What the fuck?
Although I'm sure that has happened more times than not, you know, where whether they really believe it or not, women were just kind of forced into it. So
yeah, I'm sure. And I think she just was quite, I mean, she basically was like, no, we're not giving up the estate because your children have to eat. Like, right. We have to live. Like, I don't know. Like, we support, we feed all of these servants. We give all these people work. Like, I don't know. Part of me can understand, like, why Tolstoy would be frustrated. But at the same time, like, fuck you, dude. You're a hypocrite. Like, he had become, like, his own little god. And he was trying to kind of, like, do his own... it basically sounds like a cult, kind of, like, in the research I was doing.
If you look at, like, these cults and these leaders that sort of take it to that next level, once people start following them, and, you know, absolute power corrupts absolutely, isn't that the quote? Like, you know, when you're given that kind of power, not everybody can handle it.
Yeah.
And they misuse it, and they miss, you know.
Yeah.
And that is very well what could have happened, is that it all went to his head. That these disciples were like, well, obviously you're right, and you're our God or whatever.
Yeah. And then that Chirkov guy, like, took advantage, like, he definitely, like, put himself in this position where he could get all of a sudden all this power by controlling Tolstoy. So,
and you also don't know. I mean, things like Alzheimer's, dementia, those kind of things, those still happened back then. They just weren't diagnosed.
Exactly.
So you never know. He may have started to lose it, and the guy was like, well, I can easily manipulate this guy, and who cares? She's just a woman.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And he just saw dollar signs.
Well,
Google signs.
And power, like, and this ultimate power. It's funny, in the movie, in Last Station, Chirkov is played by Paul Giamatti.
Oh, that's amazing. He's so good at playing a bad guy.
He's so good.
I mean, he's good at playing good guys too, but I love it when he's the bad guy.
Yeah. Well, there's this whole scene in the movie where they have Tolstoy, like, in this meadow with the new will, and they're like, they want him to sign it, but nobody brought a pen. It was pretty funny.
That's hilarious.
But I still felt like, so Helen Mirren, like, her performance is a powerhouse in that movie. She deserves her Oscar nomination. But also, they, like, the movie definitely plays into this, like, this idea that she was so, like, hysterical all the time. And she goes into these fits. And it is true that actually, it is true that when he first leaves, when he was, like, 80, when he gets on that train to leave, convinced by Chekhov he's got to go, she actually throws herself into the pond and tries to drown herself, and they fish her out, and she's okay. That like, really happened. So there definitely was, like, a lot of angst and a lot of that kind of, like, fire, but also that passion. But I feel like the movie really plays into that and has, like, a whole scene of her, like, smashing dishes against the wall and, like, all of this. And
well, for those of us who have read Anna Karenina, I mean, it's not like there's any lack of drama in that book either.
I know. This was, you know what, Amelia, it was like, first of all, Sophia is obviously, like, a heroine of mine now. I loved Tolstoy, and now I'm like, wow, another icon fallen.
Like, I know. Unfortunately, when you start digging through some of this stuff, you really do get disappointed.
Like, yeah. Because he also, like, lets that, I mean, like, that final quote I read says, like, it's like he, like, Chertkov was leading that smear campaign, but, like, Tolstoy let it happen.
Exactly.
He let that happen. Like, yeah. He was the one who was,
like, you know, you do you. It's fine. Whatever.
And it was convenient for him to let her take the fall for all of the shit and to, you know, to basically cover his bases and.
Yeah.
So shitty. Such shitty behavior.
Boy.
But anyway, that is Sofia Tolstoyeva and The Unhappy Marriage. The unhappy and sometimes happy, but very productive. It's also called one of the most successful marriages in literature, which makes sense.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, it was long. I mean, it was definitely long term.
Successful financially, obviously, like, in terms of, like, the success of the publications and the books and.
Yeah.
God, can you imagine, though, 13 children? Can you fucking imagine?
I mean, you're right. She had to have been pregnant for more than 20 years.
Yeah, 16 pregnancies. 3 of them were miscarriages.
That's just a lot.
It's a lot.
Babies.
It's so many mouths to feed. And absolutely. At the end, you know, when he had his disciples all around there, they were all there eating from the table, and, like, they, you know, all these people there too, and she fed them too. Like, she took care of that. Obviously, she had servants. She wasn't, like, cooking all the meals by herself. But
No. She had help.
But managing an estate, like, managing a 4,000-acre estate with all that shit, like, that's a, Like, that's a lot. Like, you know.
Yeah, it would be like managing the staff of a hotel. I mean.
Basically.
Basically the general manager of her own house.
Yeah.
So.
But everything, all the articles all said that she was the one who personally educated the kids and did all that too. So she, you know. I just can't even imagine like working so hard, being pregnant so long. And then like just feeling like your husband just like doesn't give a fuck. And like, well, and then just leaves
him change and you can't figure out why, you know what I mean? Like, cause you, like you said, he turned on kind of a dime.
Yeah.
And so that had to be weird where you just wake up one day and he's like, I'm a deity. And you're like, what is happening right now? What?
Yeah. And you being like, well, wait, there's bills to pay and there's, wait, what? Like,
and we have kids and probably grandkids at that point, even maybe great grandkids at that point who were all still trying to feed. Yeah. And now you've decided you want to start a religion.
Yeah.
What's happening?
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
What a nutty story.
I know. I will never look at Anna Karenina the same way again.
I kind of want to go back and reread all of his stuff now to like try to figure out like what's the truth. But then it's also like fictionalized. So,
yeah.
You know. Yeah. Really interesting. It's an interesting story. And it's very different than the story I'm going to tell next week about Anna Dostoevskaya. But right,
well, I'm excited about that one.
Yeah. So listeners, come back next week and hear that story in stark contrast to Sophia's story, Sophia and Leo's story.
All right.
Well, thank you, Amelia, for being here and absorbing this interesting but very disturbing story. To learn more about Sophia Tolstaya, see some photos of her and some quotes from this episode, head on over to broadsyoushouldknow.com. While you're there, click on over to the About page and read more about me and Amelia, our bios, photos, links to all of our cool stuff, all right there. Are you following Broads You Should Know on social? We are on Facebook and Instagram and YouTube now at Broads You Should Know and Twitter at BYSK Podcast. Like, subscribe, and comment. That really helps us. To suggest a broad, fill out the form on our website or email us at broadsyoushouldknow@gmail.com. If you are a fan of this podcast, help spread the word about us by sharing an episode with your friends or family, or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. That really helps new listeners to find us. Broads You Should Know is produced by me, Sarah Gorski, and edited by Chloe Skye, with original music by Darren Callahan. Finally, if you were intrigued by the story of Sophia Tolstaya and all that she did to support her husband and his successes, then you should definitely check out a few of our similar other episodes, including the Background Broads episode that includes Tabitha King, Nannerl Mozart, Mozart's sister, Catherine Wright, the sister of the Wright brothers, and Edith Wilson, wife to President Wilson. See you next week for another Broad You Should Know.